A possible reversal in the Central Park jogger case, clemency petitions from death row in Illinois, and a serial sniper in Washington. Stories in the news that point to a constant in crime investigation. Tracking, finding, and prosecuting the right person relies heavily on getting the right evidence, and that can be very hard to do. Popular TV shows like CSI, Crossing Jordan, and Law & Order make evidence collection and analysis look both easy and glamorous. They invite wannabe sleuths to tag along as crimes are solved in an hour or less. Of course, life isn't like that, so today we'll do a reality check. How do police go about collecting evidence? How has the science of collecting and analyzing evidence changed in recent years? What do you do if there is no physical evidence? And how reliable are eyewitness accounts? Also, how can you be sure that the evidence collected at the crime scene will hold up in court? Join our conversation. What are your questions about the puzzle pieces that help solve crimes? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK, and our email address is totn@npr.org. Our first guest is Larry Regal. He's the retired director of forensic sciences for Orange County, California. He's also the author of the book Crime Scene. He joins us from his home in Laguna Beach, California. Welcome to the show, Mr. Regal.
Thank you.
Let's start at the beginning. You are called to the scene of a crime. Let's say it's a murder. What do you do first?
Well, the first steps, of course, are to determine if it is a murder, if the victim's still alive. And usually there's paramedics present or some heroic type individual from the fire department that would verify that this is a dead person. If that's the case, then the coroner would be also be notified, and the rest of the crime scene investigating team would be notified. This would usually be a CSI type person, a photographer, one that would check for fingerprints, and a scientist like myself. So the team of four people then, and whatever police officers might be present, would begin the process. The first thing to do is to protect the scene so that it's not altered in any way. Weather and things like that, of course, are always a problem. You have more rain back there than we have here in Southern California, so we don't have that problem. And then just the process of standing there and looking and determining what about the scene looks out of place, what about the scene looks unique, and the process begins.
You know, it's interesting because I began with a question that had a misguided assumption in it. In other words, I said, oh, it's a murder. And you said, no, the first thing you have to do is find out, is it really a murder? Is that really part of what your process is, not to go into the scene with any kinds of assumptions like that?
That's correct, because I've heard some really weird tales of people who were at the scene for hours and made the assumption that the victim was dead because they looked dead, and in fact they weren't. When they went to move them 4 or 5 hours later, they were still alive.
Wow.
So it's something that has to be checked right away, and usually the paramedics will attach some of these devices that can communicate directly with a base station hospital to determine if the person is flatline.
In terms of protecting the scene, what do you touch, what don't you touch? I mean, how do you go about that all-important job of protecting the scene?
Well, the body has to be touched for that purpose we just mentioned. But then the scene itself is generally surrounded by, you know, this classic yellow tape you see now everywhere. A few years ago, we didn't have that, so they used rope. But the tape is almost endless, so it can be used to protect the scene and ideally keeps people outside of what is the scene. The other problem, of course, is when you first arrive at the scene, you really have no idea what the size of the scene is. And very often the first officer will sort of arbitrarily string some tape because it's convenient to put it from a light fixture or to a rearview mirror. But the first crime scene investigators have to verify that that is indeed the boundary of the scene.
How do you do that? How do you know how big the scene really should be?
Well, you don't. And so what I tell people, and I still teach these classes at a couple of universities here in Southern California, to just arbitrarily expand the scene out at least another 100 feet or 200 feet in every direction until they determine more about the scene. Now, sometimes there are eyewitnesses that at least have some degree of reliability to tell you what happened. The victim may be alive and can tell you what happened. So, you know, that way you can narrow down the size of the scene. But until then, you really have to protect as large an area as possible.
What happens if the scene gets violated in some way, if the people who first arrive on the scene don't pay attention to where they're moving, what they're touching, that kind of thing?
Well, then it compromises the evidence. Very often you'll find fingerprints at the crime scene that turn out to be one of the investigators who has unconsciously, shall we say, her curiosity overpowered him, and he picked something up, not realizing he was going to leave his fingerprint behind. And of course, the weather, the wind, just people who are not thinking can unintentionally step on something or kick something. A person who first comes into the scene to help, say, a wounded person, may step in some blood and leave some shoe prints that have to be very carefully determined that they were the, you know, the victim or the suspect or the witness's shoe print.
Mm-hmm.
So all those things have to be decided in this early stage. And until you know every bit of evidence, whether it's turned out to be created after the scene by mistake, has to be handled as if it was real evidence. So it's photographed, it's measured, it's drawn into a sketch, and all this becomes basically the history of the scene. I compare it to like going on a trip and collecting souvenirs. You're documenting, so you can explain later on to decision makers, the DA who has to decide whether to file a case, and eventually the jury and a judge, whether they're going to actually find this person guilty of the case.
All right, I'd like to bring in another guest now, Catherine Ramsland. She's a professor of forensic psychology at DeSales University in Center Valley, Pennsylvania. Also the author of The Forensic Science of CSI, about the science in this CBS television show. She joins us from Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. Good to have you, Ms. Ramsland.
Hi, thank you.
Let me ask you first, what do you do if there's not very much physical evidence at a crime scene?
Well, you need to do some kind of crime scene reconstruction. So what will now happen is you're going to try to look at the behavior that's evident in whatever physical evidence you do have and use behavioral analysis to reconstruct it.
Well, is that what we call profiling? Is that
to some extent that's profiling. Sometimes it's psychological autopsy. As he pointed out, you can't always assume it's a murder. It could be an accident. It could be suicide. There are all kinds of things that could be going on if you have a body. So there's a technique called psychological autopsy as well that's not profiling. But profiling is strictly about trying to narrow down suspects and prioritize leads by looking at the type of behavior we can see quite clearly in this scene.
I have never, ever heard that that term before, I have to say, psychological autopsy, and I'm sort of trying to imagine what it is.
Well, what it is that you are looking, it's almost like the victimology part of profiling, where they try to look at everything about the victim. They look at journals. They try to figure out where this person might have encountered the person who assaulted them. But psychological autopsy is looking strictly at the victim. We're not trying to find out who did this to him or her. And you use journals, you use telephone calls, you use correspondences, emails, what friends have to say, records, to piece together almost a mini biography of the person so that you can determine if there was a reason why they might have killed themselves. This is only used in equivocal deaths or deaths where there are too many ambiguous factors to know exactly what happened. So you're trying to see if the person, there were changes in their habits, appetites, whatever, to try to determine if it potentially could have been suicide or an accident, or maybe somebody staged a suicide and actually killed them. So there's all kinds of things you're trying to do, and you have to do that by knowing the victim as well as you can.
Now, where does that take place? Not right at the crime scene.
Well, you will want to go to the crime scene. Certainly you don't want to corrupt the crime scene. You don't usually go when it's being processed. But you do want to see something about the crime scene. You want to see actual physical autopsy reports, any eyewitness reports, any police incident reports. You're going to use that as part of the reconstruction.
All right. If you'd like to join our discussion here on Talk of the Nation about collecting and analyzing evidence, the number is 800-989-TALK. That's 800-989-8255. Let's take a call from Anir in Baltimore, Maryland. Hello. Welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Hi, Lynn. My question is, to what degree does is police pressure a factor in the outcome of the investigation? And also, is it possible for manipulation of the evidence?
What do you mean by police pressure? I'm not sure I understand.
Say there's a case that needs to be solved right away, and the police may think a particular individual did it, and they want to have a match of whatever DNA, et cetera, et cetera.
Professor Thompson? Can you respond to that, Professor Thompson?
Ramsland? You're talking to?
Ms. Ramsland.
Yeah, okay. Actually, I have written quite a bit about false confessions that have been pressured by the police, and I have done cases with FBI agents where they have found police trying to manipulate the evidence because they're so sure that this is the person that they're after, and the best way to do that is to get the physical evidence looking incriminating, and that's terrible for the case. It has happened. I don't think it happens often. I think Mr. Regal can probably address that better than I can, but certainly pressure that people feel to close a case, especially if they're under the media scrutiny, may sometimes make them overdo their zeal in trying to get a confession or trying to make something look other than it is in terms of the physical evidence. I mean, everybody's human, and it's too bad that it happens. I don't think they intentionally wish to close the case fraudulently, but sometimes that is what happens.
All right, thanks so much for your call, Anir. And I would imagine that also certainly complicates things when it gets to the trial.
It definitely complicates things, and things have been thrown out, and people who've been falsely arrested or pressured into false confessions have sued, and yes, it becomes very complicated.
Mr. Regal, let me ask you a specific question about the situation we have here in the D.C. area with the sniper. We've heard that at the site of each shooting, there are actually two different crime scenes, one from where the sniper shoots, one at where the sniper is shooting from, and one where the victim is hit. Can you explain why that is necessary?
Well, you could call it two different crime scenes, but it's all actually one big crime scene with a lot of space in between. But they have to be processed separately, so it'd be quite okay to call it two scenes. The obvious answer to that is that at the scene where the shot was fired, depending on the weapon, if it's a semi-automatic weapon, a carbine-type weapon with a clip, it'd be an ejected shell casing. And, of course, that becomes key evidence in identifying the rifle because of the markings that are transferred to the shell casing from the firing pin and ejection mechanism. And there also could be evidence from the individual, shoe prints, tire tracks, trace evidence, perhaps, if he's brushed against a tree or things such as that. And then at the scene itself, where the remains would be at this point, or the body, because I know some of these people survived, you then have to recover the bullet. If it has exited the body, there's going to be some evidence of where it hit the next surface. And perhaps then you could also determine the angle and get back to where you find this other crime scene. It's not always easy to find the scene where the shot was fired from.
Yeah,
there has to be some way to get the correct angle, and usually people who are in the area have no idea what's happened, and it's too late. I do understand in a couple of cases people have seen the person.
All right, well, thanks very much. We have to say goodbye now to Larry Regal for joining us. Thanks so much for joining us, Mr.
Regal. Okay.
He is the retired director of forensic sciences for Orange County, California, also the author of the book Crime Scene. And Mr. Regal joined us from his home in Laguna Beach, California. We're talking today about the art and science of evidence collection. We're taking your calls at 800-989-TALK. What are your questions about how crimes are solved? You can also send us an email. The address is TOTN@npr.org. I'm Lynn Neary. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. We'll be right back. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington. Neal Conan has jury duty today. We are talking today about forensic science. Our guests are Catherine Ramsland. She is writes about forensic science and psychology for Court TV's website, Crime Library. Joining us now is William Thompson. He's a professor in the Department of Criminology, Law, and Society at the University of California, Irvine. He's a lawyer, and he joins us from his home in Irvine. You're also invited to join the discussion. What are your questions about the quality of evidence and how it factors into building cases? Give us a call at 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. Professor Thompson, thanks so much for joining us.
Glad to join you.
You know, like it or not, a lot of people get their ideas about how crimes are solved from television. Often on TV, the eyewitness is crucial to solving the crime. Is that the case in real life?
Yes.
Yes.
I would say eyewitnesses are one of the major means of solving crimes.
But I understand also that they can be very unreliable sometimes.
Well, certainly we've learned that over the past few years. I mean, one bit of evidence is from all of these cases where DNA evidence has exonerated people after conviction. And the statistics show that 80 to 85% of those cases, the person was convicted falsely in the first place based in part on eyewitness testimony. So eyewitnesses can be quite sincere about their identification and still be wrong. We know that.
Let's talk a little more about DNA. How much has the development of DNA technology changed criminal investigations?
Well, it certainly provided an important new tool that makes it possible to solve categories of crimes that could never have been solved before. The new technologies make it possible to type genetic material from just a handful of human cells. So it's now possible to get DNA types from licked stamps, envelopes, pieces of paper somebody may have handled. So very tiny quantities of material can potentially be typed and characterized genetically in order to help identify somebody.
So you can collect DNA at a crime scene, like you could collect a fingerprint.
It's done all the time. Yes, that's. I'm sure that's one of the major things that crime scene investigators like Mr. Regal look for, is any sort of biological evidence that may contain genetic information about the person who left it.
What are some of the other technological developments that may have changed the whole art and science of evidence collection and analysis in recent years?
Well, these are really very interesting times for forensic sciences. On the one hand, we're seeing a whole stream of new technologies come online that we haven't had before, like DNA analysis and some of the more higher-tech means of chemical analysis and assays. Yeah, and on the other hand, we're seeing a lot of older technologies that may be important coming under increased scrutiny and not always withstanding critical analysis.
Like what? What older technologies are you talking about?
Well, in connection with the sniper case, things like ballistics comparisons and what's called comparative bullet lead analysis, where for example, if a suspect is picked up with a gun and some bullets, cartridges in a case, a comparison to see whether a bullet from the crime scene could have come from that box of cartridges, for example. Those techniques have been used for a number of years and have quite recently come under some criticism as to whether there's adequate scientific foundation for the kinds of conclusions that experts have drawn from them.
Ms. Ramsland, I want to get you back in the discussion. Something else that we always sort of see on television, I'm going to do a little truth squatting of TV shows here.
Okay.
Fibers always seem to play an incredible, important role in solving a crime. Is that really true also?
Well, and television, it's true.
I mean, in real life.
It can be a contributing piece of evidence. At no point, I think, is anyone convicted on fiber evidence alone unless it's really unique. The problem with fiber evidence is that it's a class kind of evidence. This fiber is consistent with the one we found on the body or the one we found at the scene. We can't say, unless it's very unique, that what its actual source was. And so sometimes the fiber evidence on these TV shows is made a little bit more attention to out of context, because typically that kind of evidence is going to be considered within a larger context of other things and not just the fiber itself.
All right, I have an email here, which either of you can respond to, that sort of follows up on this. This is from Ken Larson. He says, I have a question for your guests. I've been watching CSI lately. That's the television program, Crime Scene Investigators. And I see them finding a single hair in a home that solves a case. Mm-hmm. I have a hard enough time finding my cell phone in my home. How do CSI people find evidence that small? Is it specialized training or is it just TV writing?
Well, they can find it. They have vacuum, special vacuums with filters. They use lint rollers. They use all kinds of ways to pick up things that we ordinarily can't see because we're not looking for them. They are looking for them. They're looking for anything that's unusual or out of place or could potentially have DNA evidence on it, like a hair might have a follicle on the root, which could be analyzed for DNA. So that's going to be crucial for them because they're looking specifically for it. They're probably going to see it a little more easily than people who are just walking around not noticing.
Let me just ask one follow-up, Professor Thompson. I mean, how are people trained? How do you train people to do that, to look so closely and to know what to look for?
Well, part of the problem in this area is that there are only a handful of academic training programs for forensic scientists and criminalists. So traditionally, a lot of the training has been through apprenticeship and on-the-job training in police departments. And that's created a problem with a lot of unevenness in the quality of the work. But I think increasingly there's more academic writing about it and discussion of how to do it well. People like Larry Regle, who write books about it, are trying to improve the area and make it more scientific than it's been in the past.
We're talking about evidence collection and analysis on Talk of the Nation. If you'd like to join us, the number is 800-989-8255. Let's go to Pat in Richmond, Virginia. Hi, Pat.
Hello.
Go ahead.
I have a question. I'm writing a story, and I can't figure out how to make the detective find the criminal when the murder victim is blown up and all of the suspects are equally without alibis, with equal opportunity to commit the crime and with equal, they're going to profit from the crime. Where would you start with that?
Is one of them a butler?
No. Actually, no. One of them is a psychiatrist, though.
That's it.
How badly is the victim blown up?
Oh, obliterated.
I mean, no pieces left? No pieces of the bomb left? That's pretty... doesn't happen.
Pieces.
Okay. Are you doing stuff with how people are associated with this victim? You're going to have to... You know, like I do a psychological autopsy in a way, show the biography and how all of these different people fit into that. That would be certainly part of it.
And what I'm asking you is, how would they approach the crime scene itself to get evidence?
Well, they're going to definitely be looking for pieces of the bomb because that's going to show them a lot about. There are certainly bombers who leave a signature of some kind in the way that they build the bomb, the what they use, the parts they use. So they're really going to be looking for parts of the bomb as well as any other kind of thing like footprints and whatnot.
Yeah, and I assume they would also be checking out the suspects to see if any of them have access to explosives and so on. So.
All right. Yeah. I hope that helps you, Pat.
Thank you.
All right, let's take another call. John in Brooklane, Virginia. Hello, and welcome to Talk of the Nation. John, go ahead.
Yeah, I'm a retired fire investigator and also dealt with explosives. I can probably answer this young lady's question. One of the things, your crime scenes, if it is involving a building, you're going to be working above the ceiling, within the walls, up in the trees, on the roof. Your crime scene's really going to dimensionally expand. Hello?
Hello, I'm listening, yes.
Yeah. And the same way working a crime scene when you've had an arson and your building's collapsed. A lot of work in those crime scenes takes a lot of pages right out of an archaeologist textbook. You're working down layer by layer very painstakingly. But it's possible on an explosion with an explosive device to literally retrieve quite a few pieces of that device to be able to reconstruct it. To know, one, the type of explosive used, the way it was detonated, where the materials were obtained from. And from that point on, you start getting your leads now into your parties that put it together, their amount of technical knowledge and skill. Obviously, you have where the parts may have come from, such as Radio Shack or something like that.
Hmm.
And that requires a lot of footwork, requires a lot of time, but they're quite possible to track these folks down.
One other question I have for you, John, is you were saying that, I mean, how do you know, we got into this a little bit earlier, but I'm wondering how you know, how big, does a crime scene keep expanding? I mean, how do you know when you've actually really got the whole crime scene?
Basically, in some cases, in order to evaluate a scene, in my career, I've had a piece of aerial apparatus on the scene. I've been up in a aerial bucket on a fire truck way up over the top of the scene, and I'm looking literally down on the scene. I can see a good idea, a good scope. In some cases, a helicopter or another aerial view is used to determine, you know, possible location of a sniper, good vantage points for shooting. You can surveil the scene. You may have to take literally an entire city block. Oklahoma City was an example where your crime scene literally stretched for blocks.
Right.
But, you know, even speaking in terms of profiling, it's not always the, in fact, often isn't just the incident scene where the major thing occurred. You may have a crime scene where the victim encountered a murderer, for example, and where they else they went, and then where he actually did the killing, and then where the body dump site is.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe he moved it twice. So you may have crime scenes all over the place that are secondary and tertiary.
And you're collecting evidence at each one of those different sites.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And secondary, if you've got like again your arsonist or your bomber, for instance. When you do track that party down, their subsequent residence, dwelling, workshop, whatever, becomes yet another crime scene, overall part of that first big crime scene.
Yeah.
So that's another whole area to work.
Thanks so much for your call, John.
All right.
Another email here that I'd like to address to Professor Thompson. This is from Evelyn Bruce in Virginia Beach, Virginia, and she says, does the quality of crime investigating tools vary from one law enforcement group to the next? I guess she's really asking me, how does the quality of an investigation vary, and does it depend on what's available in one police or one law enforcement agency versus another?
Yes, I think it does, to an unfortunate degree, probably. In my legal work, I've seen lots of variation in the quality of the investigation, simply in terms of things like how well documented is the crime scene varies a lot. How much material is collected? Some jurisdictions are able to send specialist criminalists to the scene to collect evidence. Other jurisdictions rely on detectives to do the work. And so there's lots of variation. And as Mr. Regal pointed out, people who are not well trained and not careful can end up missing things or even messing up the evidence and in ways that it would interfere later with inferences about what happened.
And how common is that? I mean, how common is it that the investigators really mess up the investigation?
Wow, it's hard to say. I mean, this often becomes a matter of debate during criminal trials. And if you ask prosecutors, the answer is never. And if you ask defense attorneys, the answer is every time.
Mm-hmm. There's not been any studies done where we could really know a percentage either. And maybe things have been messed up that we haven't even detected yet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, what can a criminal investigator do to at least try and ensure that the evidence they're so carefully collecting and painstakingly collecting will stand up in court?
Well, I think careful documentation is the key. You know, photographing the scene early on. I mean, I think that the O.J. Simpson case, I think, is an interesting example of how sloppy collection efforts can later be attacked by the defense and to show inconsistencies and problems that raise doubts. So I think that training the analyst how to handle different classes of evidence is important. I mean, early on, when DNA testing first came online, many crime scene analysts and detectives were not well trained in how to collect and preserve blood and other tissue samples, and did it in ways that promoted rapid degradation. So I think it's an area where the law enforcement people who are doing this work have to become more familiar with scientific research, and there has to be some connection between academic sciences and law enforcement to make it work as well as it can.
If you'd like to join our discussion about collecting evidence, the number is 800-989-8255, and you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Let's go to Ed. Ed, hello, welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Good afternoon. Can you hear me all right?
I can hear you. You're on the road, I understand.
Well, at the moment, I pull over to the side for safety purposes.
Okay. Go ahead.
I'm a retired detective sergeant from New York City Police Department, and I thought it was very interesting when they mentioned about the training for an investigator. Something came up during the 93 bombing of the World Trade Center where someone mentioned to some of our officers at the scene, he said, boy, you guys are good. He said, well, it's not that we're good. We just get a lot of practice. And unfortunately, in a city such as New York, you'll probably find the same thing in Philadelphia, Los Angeles, Chicago. We do get a lot of practice at it. And we also try to get the best training we can and link that up with, like someone mentioned, an apprenticeship. Working with some of the more senior people in the field, you do learn some newer techniques, and you do practice a lot. Sometimes you end up on a high-profile case, and you try not to redo the mistakes that were done out in L.A. during the O.J. Simpson case. It's a fascinating field, and it can really make or break your case for you.
Yeah, I'm wondering if larger cities have an advantage in terms of the number of people that they can send to a crime scene, the sophistication. They probably have more money. They can have more sophisticated technology. Is it an advantage to be an investigator in a larger city, Ms. Ramsland? Or
I think you're certainly going to find what this retired detective is saying. You go to a city like Boulder where they did not have much experience with homicide. All of a sudden they're faced with this huge worldwide issue over the JonBenet Ramsey murder. And it was very clear they did not know what to do, and probably because they didn't have a lot of practice. So, yeah, I think certainly the sophistication of the crime lab and the constant experience that people get learning to read the scene and learning to figure out what happens more quickly and knowing what to do right away is definitely different from one jurisdiction to another.
Yeah, I think one of the big problems is that the people collecting evidence at the crime scene have to be familiar with the technologies that will be brought to bear to analyze the evidence later on. And one of the problems with DNA testing is that the DNA tests have become so sensitive that they can detect very tiny quantities of material. And it's created a new potential for accidental contamination of evidence.
All right. We're going to continue this discussion in a moment. We're going to take a short break right now. I'm Lynn Neary. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, on the web at macfound.org, the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, sponsor of Reclaiming Futures, Building Community Solutions to Teenage Substance Abuse and Crime, reclaimingfutures.org, and WorldSpace, offering NPR programming for Europe, Africa, and the Middle East on digital satellite radio. Information at npr.org/worldwide. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
I'm Lynn Neary. For many, it's the American dream, a town that's safe, where you can raise your kids and make a decent living. That's exactly what attracted some 2,000 Somalis to Lewiston, Maine. But now the mayor is pulling the welcome mat. Immigration in a small town. Next Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Thank you.
This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington. Tomorrow, a look at political dynasties. Are they good for the political process, or do they create an American political royalty? Today, we are talking about evidence in police work. In the D.C. area, the police have been collecting evidence on the sniper who's been linked to 13 shootings so far. 10 people have died. The most recent victim was a bus driver shot on the steps of his bus yesterday morning. Joining us now here in Studio 3A is NPR's Larry Abramson. Thanks for joining us, Larry.
Hi,
Larry, the most recent development in the case is that the police did announce today that they have linked yesterday's shooting with the others. Based on what evidence do they make that kind of...
Well, of course, this looked like the act of the sniper, but we never know this for sure until we have analyzed the ballistics evidence, that is the bullet or the bullet fragments, and possibly a shell casing. But we basically, in this case, they looked at the bullet. They are able to compare it with the other bullets using very, very fine imaging technology that the alcohol, tobacco, and firearms people bring to bear. And they can basically tell that this came from the same gun. This is probably the leading piece of evidence that the police have shared with us that they're using in every single case here. And, of course, it can establish a link to the other killings. What it can't really do is tell you who owns the gun that's doing this. Mm-hmm. In this country, they use this database for linking bullets to crime, to guns that have been used in crime. So if this gun has been used in a crime before, it's possible they would get some more information about it. There's been proposals out there to make every gun be fired before it's sold so that you could link it back to the original owner, but that doesn't exist right now.
Well, do they have any other evidence, or what are their...
Yes, they do. Some of this we know from press reports. Some of it we know from Chief Moose, but a lot of it is sort of leaking out to the press. For example, it's pretty clear that they did get this tarot card that we heard about. It was left at the scene of the shooting of that 13-year-old junior high school student in Prince George's County. I guess it must be 2 weeks ago. And now it's pretty well established that they did find a note at the scene of the shooting on Saturday in Ashland, and that's the note that apparently contained this threat against children, saying your children are not safe anywhere at any time. Several newspapers, Washington Post and the Baltimore Sun, are reporting that another note was found after yesterday's shooting that repeated much of the same information, including a demand for money. As far as evidence is concerned, of course, it doesn't matter what it says as much as whether they can get handwriting out of it. They may be able to determine whether, in fact, these notes were written by the same person, because, again, it's always possible that the person who's leaving these notes behind is trying to profit from this crime, is trying to irritate police, but may not be the shooter. I think that they think that it is the shooter, and in some ways they're hoping it is, just because this is one of their best leads.
And the police have been really reluctant to divulge the details of these letters that they've gotten.
Well, this is very controversial. I mean, some people feel, and some of these people are former cops, that it would be good to share this information with the public. You remember that the Unabomber was caught after his brother read his manifesto in the newspaper, said, "This sounds a lot like my brother," and he called investigators. Otherwise, they wouldn't really solve that case. Some people feel they should share these particular notes with the public so somebody could say, "That looks like my brother's handwriting," or "That looks like his phraseology," or "That some weird word that he used." The police have decided not to do this. It may be, there can be a lot of reasons for this, and some of your guests may know better than I. One reason that was advanced to me is if you have false confessions, which frequently happens in these kinds of cases, somebody who says, "I did it," one way to prove them wrong or right is to say, "Tell us a detail, tell us something that was left behind." And that kind of information could tell you what was on the note. If it's shared with the public, of course, everybody knows that.
You know, what about the role of eyewitnesses and tips in this particular case, Larry?
Well, they're talking about having 67,000 tips. It's just an overwhelming amount of evidence. They've clearly succeeded in mobilizing the public to share information. The problem is we don't know whether any of that evidence is reliable or, more importantly, helpful. One person, as you know, gave deliberately false descriptions a couple of weeks ago, and he's actually in jail because of that. He described the weapon, he described the shooter, he described the van that he saw. So police investigators, however, have to go through all these tips, including bogus ones, in order to figure out what's right and what's wrong. And I think many investigators feel that their ability to prioritize things and put the most promising leads first will determine how quickly they're able to solve the investigation. They clearly want more information from the public. Of course, they don't want more bad information.
Yeah. How many people are working on this case now, Larry?
Well, I don't have exact numbers, but the federal government is contributing over 1,000 investigators on their own. They just released a list of the people who were there from the Secret Service, the Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms Service, the FBI. And that, of course, doesn't count Montgomery County Police, Prince George's County Police, Hanover County, Henrico County, all of these different counties which have substantial police forces, town police who are involved. It's an extraordinary number of people. So if this investigation can't be failing because of the lack of resources, it's just a question of how well they're able to use them and how smart this guy is.
All right. Thanks very much for joining
us. Thank you, Lynn.
NPR's Larry Abramson. And with me still are Catherine Ramslin. She's a professor of forensic psychology at DeSales University in Center Valley, Pennsylvania. Also, William Thompson, professor in the Department of Criminology, Law, and Society at the University of California, Irvine. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a call at 800-989-TALK. Professor Thompson, we just heard from Larry Abramson about the huge number of people who are working on this case. Is that really uncommon, and how helpful is it to have that many people on one case?
Oh, I think it's probably unique to these sensational high-profile cases. I haven't had much experience with it. I imagine it would be a logistics nightmare trying to coordinate all the different tips and put all the information together.
And can you imagine when there's that many people working on it, that does it create more room for error?
Well, we have to think about what the sources of error are. I mean, if I would think that they would want to confine the crime scene investigation to a fairly limited number of people, and hopefully people who'd worked together before and could coordinate their efforts. So I think it wouldn't necessarily. I mean, I think the bigger dangers would be if a suspect is picked up, that there might be some danger of confirmatory bias in the investigation. I mean, I think it'd be very unfortunate if we had a situation like happened with Richard Jewell in Atlanta, where somebody's picked up who looks like a possible suspect, and this entire huge law enforcement apparatus went into overdrive looking for ways to confirm his guilt rather than to actually test guilt or innocence.
Right.
So, I mean, I think that's the danger if you have too many people who are too eager to solve the crime, that maybe they won't be looking at the evidence as critically as they should.
Yeah, we had too many people at Waco as well. We had thousands of law enforcement from all different agencies, and that didn't necessarily help get that situation resolved well.
Okay.
I think it can create a hothouse atmosphere where everybody's competing with each other to share the limelight and glory, and that can lead to unfortunate pressures that lead the investigation in a way that it shouldn't go.
And in this case, you have huge media coverage and intense concern on the part of the public, so that, you know, just living here in this city, I know you see, for instance, a white van and you think, should I be calling the police and telling them I'm seeing a white van? I mean, people are having trouble sifting through what's the important stuff we should be passing on. Do you have any idea? Do you have any, how does the member of the public even know what kind of tip they should be passing on to the police? Professor Thompson,
I have no idea. I'm as much at a loss as you are.
Yeah. And what about the media? What role does the media play in a situation like this? Does it make it much more difficult for the investigators?
Well, as I said, I think the major danger is that people are attracted to the limelight and can encourage investigators to do things that they wouldn't otherwise do, to come forward too early with tips, just to be overly eager to find and confirm the guilt of a suspect. In the case like Richard Jewell, for example, or some of these other cases where perhaps the Central Park jogger case as well, where there's tremendous public pressure to crack the case and to solve it. And those are the very cases where we sometimes see miscarriages of justice because people rush forward too quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And there's such a desire to solve it that the evidence isn't isn't viewed as skeptically as it should. And there's a strong tendency for people to, once they have a suspect, to look to confirm guilt rather than to look for possible disconfirmatory evidence. And that can lead to distortions.
William Thompson is a professor in the Department of Criminology, Law and Society at the University of California, Irvine. And you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Let's go to Harvey in Chelsea, Michigan. Hello, Harvey. Go ahead.
Yes, I've been listening to all these talk shows on TV for the last, month, and I have not heard one single person say, look, all these millions of people in this area, arm yourselves with your camcorders, your digital cameras. Don't pull your blinds down. Lift them up. Leave them on while you're sleeping. Put them in your car when you're at the stores. Somebody's going to catch something because 5 blocks away after this person shoots somebody, they're walking away, and it doesn't seem like anything to see somebody coming out of the woods on the other side, but then you find out an hour later that, a murder had occurred on the other side. So I think everybody is walking around, and the sniper sees on TV that everybody has their camcorders. If anything happens in, this 100-mile radius, somebody's going to catch it. And I haven't heard anybody mention, that as a tool that we can all use.
Let me ask Catherine Ramsland about that. Is that useful? Would that be useful to investigators?
Well, I don't think anyone wants to put themselves out there as a potential target either, just walking around with a camcorder. I think there are going to be lots of people who feel quite frightened about doing something like that, but also not everybody owns one, first of all. And I don't know I think that they could pick something up. I'm not sure that could necessarily be helpful, especially if people are sending in their tapes. We've already got 67,000 leads. Now we're going to get piles and piles of tapes of people who think maybe this is helpful or think they might get paid if they come forward with this. And now they're going to be overwhelmed with all of that as well. I'm not sure that the rewards of that would outweigh some of the negative things.
All right, let's see if we can get one more call. Alicia in Lawrence, Kansas. Hi, Alicia.
Hi.
Go ahead.
I'm actually a college student, and I'm very much interested in the psychological and sociological analysis of a crime scene. Where do I start? I've talked with police detectives and sergeants from 3 different districts in Kansas City, and they all say start as a beat cop and work your way up. But where do I go for school? I've heard don't get a criminology degree because they'll send you to the academy anyway, and don't go federal. Where do I start?
I wonder if Professor Thompson, who's a professor of criminology, would agree with that. Professor Thompson?
Well, I think it depends on your goal. Is your goal to be a forensic scientist and analyze physical evidence? Or
no, not the physical stuff. More the criminal profiling and the psychological stuff that I'm fascinated with.
Well, maybe Professor Ramsland should address this then.
All right. Okay.
There are 2 ways to go. You can go into law enforcement and join the FBI and be one of the very few who are selected out of the field agents who have to have a lot of years of experience first.
Uh-huh.
Or you go into a forensic psychology program and then become familiar with crime scenes and local law enforcement so that you could become a consultant. And that's not often used, but you could actually build a consulting business with local law enforcement to do that through a forensic psychology program. So there are a couple of ways you could go about doing that.
Is there a specific school that I should look at?
Well, the one I really liked was John Jay in Manhattan. I'm not sure where you are or where you want to stay.
I can move East Coast, eh?
There are several schools that are getting programs going in response to all the interest. And so really, depending on where you want to go, there's probably a program somewhere. There's a good one in Arizona, one in Florida, one in Washington, one in Philadelphia. I mean, I could name a lot of them if I knew more what you were clearly interested in.
Thanks.
Thanks very much for your call, Alicia.
So it doesn't make sense to move from detective, from like a beat cop up to detective. It makes sense to actually go for a degree in this field.
If you really want to be in psychology and work in that particular arena, I think you should go into one of those programs and make your connections through that.
Okay, right. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much, Alicia.
Bye.
That's really all we have time for today in our discussion. I want to thank our guest. Catherine Ramsland is the author of The Forensic Science of CSI, about the science in this CBS television show, and she writes about forensic science and psychology for Court TV's Crime Library. Also, William Thompson, he's a professor in the Department of Criminology, Law, and Society at the University of California, Irvine. Thanks so much, both of you, for being with us.
Thank you.
Thanks.
In Washington, I'm Lynn Neary, NPR News.